carrefour des arts. À la redécouverte du théâtre musical. Une émission proposée par Christophe Mirambeau sur Canal Académie.
Da war schon zu sehen, das Kind wird wunderschön, wie ein Standbild aus Athen. Die Männer wurden grün von Neid, die Mädchen in der Stadt, die sagten nur kein Neid, wer hat, der hat. Was kann der Siegesmund dafür, dass er so schön ist? Was kann der Siegesmund dafür, dass man ihn liebt? Die Leute tun, als ob die Schönheit ein Vergehen ist. Man soll doch froh sein, dass es so was Schönes gibt. Was kann der Siegesmund dafür, dass er so schön ist? Ist nicht der Siegesmund ein süßer Kavalier? Und dass er immer bei den Damen gern gesehen ist? Was kann der Siegesmund dafür?
Welcome to Carrefour des Arts. This is not Maurice Chevalier speaking here, just Christophe Mirambeau in English. So, forgive my English, receiving Mr. Kurt Gunzel in Paris. Hello, Kurt Gunzel, and
hello,
welcome
Chris.
Here. So, you're very well known from the American and English audience for your work about musicals and history of the operetta, American operetta, English operetta, and European light opera. And now you're publishing a new huge book dedicated to Emily Soldine. So, who is Emily Soldine?
Well, yes, of course, in the 21st century and probably in most of the 20th century, nobody remembered her. But certainly in the 19th century, she was one of the greatest stars of the British musical theatre and probably in the worldwide, English-speaking, obviously, musical theatre. She began her career as a vocalist, singing in the big concerts of in London of the 1850s with all the great stars, Grisi, De Mursca, Sims Reeves, Charles Santley. She went from there to sing operatic music in the British music halls, where she became one of the biggest stars of the British music hall under a different name, as one did in those days, because ladies who sang in concerts at the big halls were not supposed to sing in music halls as well, or at least not admittedly. And because she had that combination of talents, the music hall and the serious concert, she proved to be an ideal material when opera bouffe, French opera bouffe, hit London. And she made her debut in La Grande Duchesse, followed by Chilpéric, Le Petit Faust, and then made the hit of the era, playing Drogon in Genevieve de Brabant, which was, strange enough, the most successful Offenbach operetta in England, partly thanks to her.
Was it big successes like Gilbert and Sullivan ones, or different kinds of?
Well, Gilbert and Sullivan, I suppose you could call opera bouffe anglaise. It's got its own particular flavour, because W.S. Gilbert had his own particular flavour. But in the end, it's perhaps not so far from the esprit of Mayak and Halévy and their contemporaries, because putting French opera bouffe into English was a terribly difficult thing. In the end, when you read today the texts of the big opera bouffe successes of the 1870s in England, and you compare them with the originals, I'm afraid that England comes out a bad 14th best. Certainly they did not catch the spirit of Mayak and Halévy. But on the other hand, latterly, they did sort of develop an English style that was similar. And Gilbert did it best of all, of course.
Was it a success about the music or about the lyrics? Do you think it's just the music?
For Genevieve de Brabant? Or for,
yeah.
For Genevieve de Brabant, it was a combination of circumstances. Yes, of course, it was the music, although the adapter did, I'm afraid, pop in one or two other bits and pieces from the French music hall that really oughtn't to have been there. The book was reasonably faithfully adapted, but it was well adapted to be popular in England. Another big plus was the casting. Emily Saldin really was a big force in making the thing a huge success. Also, the director did something that was slightly new and pinched, of course, from the French, like everything was in those days. He put a lot of girls into the show. Girls in dressed as boys, with their legs showing and all that sort of thing. And Jean-Pierre de Bramont became, in its little theatre, little out-of-the-way theatre, became the favourite place for the nobility out for a dirty night on the town to come. So, you know, Emily was spending her time with Lord this and the Duke of that. And, of course, where the nobility led, the bourgeoisie followed. And Jean-Pierre de Brabant, which was supposed to run for 3 months, ended up by running for 3 years. Then she took it off around the world to America, Australia, New Zealand. And and all that, of course, is what I went into when writing the book. And that's why writing the book was such good fun, because I had to travel all around the world to get the material. And that's why my book ended up at 1,500 pages instead of 300 pages, because there was such an awful lot to find.
Oh, yeah, and it was a 20-year work.
Yes, it was a 20-year work. I mean, I could have done it in less, I suppose, but unfortunately I sort of had to earn my bread and butter by writing all sorts of other books in the meanwhile, and she was my kind of pet and sat on the shelf next to my desk in every moment that I could when I wasn't doing something else I would devote to Emily. But the big thing that happened, I suppose you have to say, after I'd been round the world and to all these places digging up material, was the internet. Because I posted the fact that I was doing a book on Emily Saldin, and I was looking for this on a website. And out of the woodwork came descendants, people who were descendants of the other people in the story, all sorts of stuff. And then on eBay suddenly turns up a bundle of Emily Saldin letters, for heaven's sake, which, of course, I had to buy. So stuff was coming in. When I thought I'd finished the book and was ready to send it to the publishers, whole heap of new stuff came in, so that was 4 years more work. And then I kept on, when had already gone to the publisher, saying, well, hold the presses, I've found something else. Hold the presses, I've found something else. In the end, of course, you have to let go. Otherwise, I'd be dead before the damn thing was published. And so, yes, it came out in April 2007.
Do you allow me to say that it's your second masterpiece and chef d'oeuvre after the Encyclopedia of Musical Theatre? Is it?
I think first equal, please, because Emily has a special place in my heart, because even the Encyclopedia didn't take me 20 years. And yeah. I've lived with her for so long. Actually, life's going to be very empty now that she's gone out of it, because I have thrown myself into something else similar, but I think I've decided that probably after that I can do no better, and it's time for me to retire and go off and race my racehorses.
What kind of star Emily was? Was she like the huge French 19th century one, Hortense Schneider, or what?
Physically, when she was young, she was voluptuous and had a very pretty face, but it was obvious from quite early on that she was going to be a big girl. When she was in her 30s and playing her major roles and doing her earliest tours of the world, she was still a very attractive woman with a very fine, high mezzo-soprano voice and a great comedy style. But she was just one of those people that immediately make contact with the audience. She was always loved by the audiences and usually by the critics. Later on, she naturally put on weight and, playing some of the roles that she was still playing, her old roles, was a bit off-key, but... Then an American producer came and saw her in London and decided to put her in character ladies' parts, Les Rôles d'Esclusas. So she made the change, and she did that for a number of years. But then, of course, there has to come an end. And so she stopped performing after having gone back into burlesque and all sorts of unsuitable things. But she had to make a living. She had four children to support and no husband left. But she ended up in Australia for one last shot at being a singing star at the age of knocking 50. And of course it was a disaster. And she was stranded in Australia and not really knowing what to do. And an old friend was there, and he was quite important in the Australian newspaper world. So he said, well, why don't you write a gossip column for, do the theatre reviews first of all. And she did that so well that they gave her sort of the roundabout town column to write. And after a year or two, she was sent back to London by the Australian newspaper. And for the next 17 years, she was the London correspondent for theatre and gossip and royal things and marriages. And she had a whole page in the Australian newspaper every Sunday.
She had two careers.
She had a second career. And she also wrote two books.
Oh.
Well, the first one was a little novel, which is not bad. I mean, it's a sort of a Marie Corelli... sensation novel of its period. Hers has got a little bit of humour in it, which makes it a touch better, but it wasn't a success. But then she wrote her memoirs.
And that's my memoirs who bring you to
exactly. It was finding the memoirs that set me out on this whole 20-year thing, because the memoirs are probably the best book on the Victorian theatre ever written. It's just full of atmosphere. But, of course, what I didn't realise at the time is they were also the most scandalous.
Just go to gossip. Is Emily Soldin like Hortense Schneider another time? With affairs, with sex stories, etc.?
I don't know. I can't be sure. I don't know. She had a husband of whom she was very fond and who worked with her in the theatre as general manager. She certainly had a lot of earls and dukes floating around her, especially in her younger days. Whether they were just good friends or whether there was something more, I haven't been able to work out, but something down inside me says I think perhaps she didn't. But the rest of her company, the other young ladies in her company, the chorus girls, etc., etc., oh, yes, they certainly did. So the aristocracy came to see the show, partly because it was a good, fun and slightly dirty show, and partly because afterwards they could take a chorus girl out to supper and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Emily herself, I don't know. I suppose I'll never know unless I find a letter in an old suitcase somewhere in an attic that sort of... she certainly had close relationships several well-known men, most notably Earl of Dunraven, who was a very important politician eventually, not at the time he was running around with her. But he, I know, proposed to her what might be called a trial marriage. You know, my wife doesn't love me anymore, you know, so perhaps you can help out.
Yeah.
Whether she did or not, I don't know. I think perhaps not.
Kurt Gunzel, I know you are very addicted in French repertoire. You love French musical.
Oh, yes.
And I got a little surprise for you. Jérôme Pradon, which is a star in London now, is singing for the Fondation Saint-Gerre-Polignac an excerpt from En Chemise by Albert Villemetz and Camille, music by Raoul Moretti, and the song very, very, very witty rhymes and very funny thing is called La Girl et le Homard,
voilà.
The Girl and the Shrimp.
Et le homard, chanson vécue. C'est une girl américaine qui dansait des pas espagnols. C'était un homard phénomène qui chantait comme un rossignol. Jouant tous deux sur la même scène, le homard ressentit un choc. Et de la girl américaine, subitement il devint loufoque. Et le soir après son numéro, le homard chantait le cœur gros, sa compagnon sur le banjo.
Mais où ça?
Dans les environs de London.
That was the girl and the lobster and not the shrimp.
Right, that's it. Slightly larger.
The lobster is better than the shrimp in that case. A very, very sexual case, yeah. Yes.
Exactly. They don't write them like that anymore. More's the pity.
What about this repertoire in England or the States? Because it's very, very fun in French. Is it possible to do that in English?
Well, it would be now. In fact, you know, now seems the ideal time because most of these 1920s French shows had a small cast, no chorus or a small chorus, a small band or no band, just pianos. You know, the logistics of them for modern production, musical comedy rather than the sort of operetta grand spectacle that we're getting now coming out of England and America. Hopefully there would be a chance for them now, but at the time you couldn't. You just couldn't, because all those French operettas, I mean, the text was so sexy, the lyrics were sexy, even the music was sexy. I mean, there was just sex came out of it at every angle, and you couldn't do that in England. I mean, Mrs. Grundy would have banged her umbrella on the floor, and, you know, every lady in the audience would have fainted, probably even some of the men. You know, you just couldn't do it. The whole sort of moral basis of society and the whole sort of thing that you could do in public as opposed to in private, of course, was different. And the best example is that when the granddaddy of them all, Fifi, from 1918, yeah, was taken outside France, and it had to be because it was such a huge success in France, it went to England, it went to America, it went to Germany, and everywhere it was a flop because it had to be adapted so heavily to get rid of all the sexual references. And extra stuff was put in, the story was changed, everything. I mean, it wasn't Fifi. The only place that actually proved to have sort of the sexual intelligence and the common sense was Hungary. Don't ask me why, but I've always had a soft spot for Hungary. Maybe that's why. It was a success in Hungary. But no, by and large, none of this repertoire could be done outside France for that very reason. I mean, it was untranslatable.
Yeah, and by the way, L'Amour Masqué by Sacha Guitry and André Messager was done last year at the Edinburgh Festival in French. And okay, nobody tried to translate and adapt in English.
Well, I think I actually say in my encyclopedia, nobody up to, which was written in, what, 2002, I list the various productions of L'Amour Masqué around the world. And, you know, it's been translated into German, it's been translated into Hungarian. I said nobody has yet been game to try to translate Sacha Guitry into English. And I'd love to have a go, but I'm retired, so it won't be me.
Maybe, is it very difficult to translate the witty French rhymes into English to turn the kind of spirit?
It is.
And the kind of prosody.
Yes. I tried. I thought in my youth that I would translate Fifi. It took me about a month to do one number, and when I looked at it back, it just wasn't good enough. It is so difficult to keep the spirit of the thing, to keep the wit, and when there are puns and things like that, as there are in Fifi, or double references and all that sort of thing, I mean, it's almost a hopeless case. So the whole world's just got to learn French and listen to these things in French, because the whole world shouldn't miss them, because they're the best things, in my opinion, that were ever written for the musical theatre. And yet we hear all the time, sorry, I go on a bit about this, but, you know, we keep having pushed down our throat the American musicals of the 1920s. And, okay, you know, there's a lot there that's great fun and all the rest of it, and it's, you know, I certainly wouldn't say it was bad. I mean, of course it wasn't, it was good. But it wasn't in the same class as what the French were writing. But nobody knows that. And when I go around saying it, they all look at me as if to say, oh, you're anti-American, you are, you know.
No, you're not.
But no, of course I'm not. But, you know, that people haven't even tried it. They haven't even dipped into it to know why I'm saying what I'm saying. Probably because 9/10 of them can't read French and because it's virtually impossible to translate them.
Yeah, so let's have some witty rhymes and smart lyrics.
Yes, please.
With the finaletto primo from Fifi.
Oh, yes,
Christine
please.
And Albertville Metz.
Hélas, faut-il si tôt que mon bonheur se perde? Aspasie est outrée et m'a répondu non. Mais j'avoue que ce non paraissait avoir l'air de venir du fond du cœur et ne sentait pas bon.
Ne vous en faites pas.
Mais quel est ce jeune homme?
Voilà, monsieur vient comme modèle.
Ah, je m'explique. Dans ce cas-là, jeune homme, ôtez votre tunique.
Que dit-il?
Il vous dit simplement de quitter votre vêtement pour admirer votre plastique.
Pour avoir ma plastique, assurément, ça c'est charmant. Je vais ôter mon vêtement.
Venez vite demander, voir un nouveau modèle.
C'est un modèle, la ligne est belle. Ni gras ni gros, il est plutôt costaud. Mais il me semble que dans l'ensemble, ce jeune homme a tout ce qu'il faut.
Il pourrait faire, je crois, l'affaire.
Il est charmant, tu as sûrement raison.
Je suis mes belles, nouveau modèle. Dernier cri de la saison. Est-ce pour poser un lutteur? Nul besoin d'artifice. J'ai des membres à la hauteur. Lequel faut-il que je raidisse?
Non, je cherche un modèle pour une chose moins ordinaire. Si je vous prends, c'est pour faire.
Quoi?
Faire.
Quoi?
Faire l'amour.
Ça c'est unique et très comique, ce brave mari qui me choisit pour que je fasse, ça c'est cocasse, oui pour que je fasse l'amour. Ça c'est unique et très comique, ce brave mari qui me choisit pour que je fasse, ça c'est cocasse.
Eh bien,
sans me vanter, je crois avoir toutes les qualités.
Ah, eh ben voyons ça, mon ami.
Sans le faire à la pause, je vous déclare que j'ai pratiqué déjà toutes les poses que l'on connaît à ce sujet. Et je crois pouvoir dire, chacun sa prétention, que toutes les fois je m'en tire en donnant pleine satisfaction. Pour l'amour, je me crois des dispositions. À Cithère, j'ai pris des leçons. Je suis même allé à Singapour. Pour l'amour, je me sens tellement en effet fait. Pour vous plaire, je veux bien faire nuit et jour l'amour.
Pour l'amour, pour l'amour. Il avait disposition, à ses frères il prit des leçons, il alla même à Singapour. Pour l'amour, il est tellement en effet fait, pour nous plaire, il veut faire nuit et jour l'amour.
Eh ben ça ne me paraît pas mal du tout, hein, non?
La chose très délicate, c'est d'attraper le mouvement. En quatre temps, moi je me flatte de bien le prendre immédiatement. Et quelle que soit la tâche, une fois que j'y suis, soyez sûr que jamais je ne lâche le travail que j'ai entrepris. Pour l'amour, je me crois des dispositions. À Cithère, j'ai pris des leçons. Je suis même allé à Singapour. Pour l'amour, je me sens tellement en effet fait. Pour vous plaire, je veux bien faire nuit et jour l'amour.
Pour l'amour, il avait disposition. À Cithère, il prit les leçons. Il a la même à Singapour. Pour l'amour, il est tellement en effet fait. Pour nous plaire, il veut faire nuit et jour l'amour.
Maintenant, dites-moi, jeune homme, quel est votre nom? C'est l'habitude de la maison.
Cher monsieur, je me nomme simplement Hardimédon.
Hardimédon, 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 c'est le nom de toute la promenade, la promenade.
on se moque, l'on a que l'on acclame, Hardy Meadows.
De tant d'honneur, je suis confus, mais croyez-moi, mesdemoiselles, je ne suis qu'un simple modèle et n'ambitionne rien de plus.
Tant mieux, je crois qu'il est modeste, je le paierai meilleur marché.
Si parmi nous il reste, on va le déboucher.
So the entire concern in Fifi is just love and lovemaking. I guess it was totally impossible in English theater, English and American plots and lines.
In a way, you could say it, but it wouldn't be the same. It was just the whole thing was totally
sex is
denaturé.
Yeah, sex is obvious. Yes. In French musicals.
I mean, there are plenty of sort of British farces that have sort of sexual suggestions in them. It's just that these shows. Well, I mean, there are so many things that have got to be got right, aren't there? Because everything for me, everything in them is perfect. The balance is absolutely right. You've got a book written by the top playwrights of France, the top comic playwrights of France. You've got lyrics written by men who are writing at that stage probably the best lyrics that have ever been written in the history of the musical theatre. On top of that, you've got musicians writing for it who can not only write a chanson, a popular French song, but they can also write part music, ensembles, finales, seven-part this and six-part that. So you've got a wonderful variation in the score. You can go for one moment from a comic song, like we heard just before, which isn't usually sung as well as that, to a beautiful piece of ensemble writing. And so you get this wonderful variation through the evening, and not like in some modern shows, exactly the same music from start to finish, just with the occasional different word.
Dear Kurt, I got another surprise for you, an excerpt from Arsène Lupin Banquier by Wilmets and composer Marcel Lattès, sung at the Fondation Saint-Gerard-Polignac in April 2006.
Et qu'on veut danser le tango.
Il en faut.
from Arsène Lupin banquier, il en faut.
But you imagine that being played in 1930 on the British stage. I mean, no, you just simply couldn't. Now you could, if you could find anybody to translate it. It missed its moment, I'm afraid, in English.
Yes, it's a real...
It's a great, great shame. Because, yeah. I mean, after all, we did have, you know, we had Opéra Bouffe. And, okay, that was calmed down a bit for English. But, Emily would have had great fun with these 1920s musicals, I think. I mean, her voice might have been a bit sort of large, because, you know, she was Carmen in her day. But certainly the esprit would have been right. And I think a lot of the people who played Opéra Bouffe would have been very suitable 50 years later, if they were still around, to play the Comédie Musicale of France. Oh, dear, it would have been lovely to have been around in those days, but I'm afraid even I wasn't quite around in those days.
Do you think she would have been a good performer for that? With the spirit, with the sex context?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes, indeed. Yes. I mean, that's what they put, you know, if you don't have sex in Opéra Bouffe, I mean, where are you for heaven's sake?
You have sex, yeah. But not really written and sung in that play, in that kind of French musical theater. They make love, they fuck. Yeah. Let's say the truth.
And they talk about it and think about it all the time.
All the time.
Absolutely.
Sex is a real problem of the life.
Hmm. Well, I mean, it's just like the French non-musical theater, isn't it? I mean, all those wonderful farces.
Just like the French.
Oh, really? I must stay here longer.
You're welcome, Chris.
No, I think Emily would have certainly been very good in that sort of thing, although, of course, she was not first and foremost an actress. She was first and foremost originally a vocalist, but she certainly was a talented comedienne, and she did play once or twice. In fact, she wrote a play that was produced on Broadway, and she played a small part in it herself when she was a middle-aged elderly lady. So I think yes. I mean, she would have been a good Jean Charel.
Oh yeah.
She was a little large.
An old lady, kind of old lady.
When she was older,
saying craps and very very sexual jokes.
Exactly. Yes. I think Jean Charel with a bit more voice.
Yeah. Mm. Of course, because Jean Charel.
But the best parallel for Emily in France, I think, probably eventually is Desclosas. Is that the right pronunciation?
Yeah, Desclosas. Mm. Yeah. Which is a kind of, we have to tell to our audience that Desclosas is a singer, a French singer, which gave her name to a kind of vocal type.
Yes, okay. And well, it's the comedy character lady.
Yeah.
Comedy heavy lady.
Yeah, and it's like a mezzo-soprano. And a funny mezzo-soprano. Do you agree with my definition?
Yes, absolutely. And in actual fact, Emily and Desclosas appeared together on the stage of the London Gaiety Theatre in a big concert where one act of three different opéra bouffe were played. Desclosas went on second in La Fille de Madame Angot with the original cast from Brussels.
She did Mademoiselle Lange. Emily did Mademoiselle Lange.
Oh, gosh, yes. Yes, indeed. She wasn't the original because somebody else, she was away doing something else when it happened and another manager got hold of the rights. But as soon as she came back to town, she and her manager popped out to see the production that was being quite successful in the suburbs. And 4 weeks later, they pinched it and produced it at the Gaiety Theatre. And it turned out, after Genevieve de Brabant, to be Emily's most successful ever role, I think. Oh, she did a lot of Boccaccio later on, but in her early years, I would have said that Genevieve de Brabant, La Fille de Madame Angot, Chil Perric would have been her three most successful shows and her three best roles. And she came on after Desclosas had done Mademoiselle Lange. Emily had to come on and do the third excerpt, and she came on, of course, in Genevieve de Brabant. But what competition! Imagine those two ladies. I mean, two of the all-time greats of the Opéra Bouffe theatre on the same program.
Yes.
Wow.
But we weren't born at that
no,
time.
No, alas.
and I guess now, one day or another, you'll do another new, big, huge, fantastic edition of the encyclopedia of the musical theater, and
not me. Well, I'm working on that already. I'm lining up my successors to take over the various portions of the encyclopedia. When we go into a third edition, I shall be in the background pulling the strings, but other people can do the legwork. Things have gone further since I wrote the Encyclopedia of the Musical Theatre, which is very broad and therefore, of course, can't be terribly deep in each area that it goes into. Since I did that, other people have taken what I've done and they've taken it further. They've gone more deeply into things, and which is absolutely right and absolutely the way it should be. And so, as I say, when it comes to the next edition, I'm going to grab a few of those young people who have done that, and they can expand what I started, and I shall sit there in the back and be the sort of eminence grise. And then, of course, when we come around to the fourth edition and the fifth edition and the sixth edition, I probably still won't be here, but there'll be somebody around to take it over.
Yes, like a running book and
I hope so.
A work in progress.
I hope so. I mean, I hope it will carry on, because, I mean, we need a book like that, which is why I wrote it in the first place.
Yeah.
But of course, as the years go on and more study gets done, it needs to say more. So that's why I went from a first edition in two volumes in 1994 to a second edition in three volumes in 2002. So probably come about 2010 or 2015, we'll end up in four volumes. And in the end, we'll end up like the Dictionary of National Biography or Grove, you know, in 23 volumes.
Yeah, and
maybe. I won't be around to see it, but maybe.
Yeah, maybe. But you open a way for historians and theatre goers too, because now
I hope so.
It's natural to have a Genzel in the library. And,
thank you.
and open your book to go to the theatre. So it's a huge step for the world of history of musical theater.
Well, I hope so. And as I say, I hope it will go further, that other people will take it further, which they're already doing. And I love to sit back and watch it happening.
Kurt Gunzel, I thank you very, very,
thank
very
you.
Much for the end of our broadcast. I'd love to propose you a last French Between the War musical surprise, the title song from Yes, a musical by Maurice Yvain, performed by Léovanie Rowe at the Fondation Saint-Jacques-Polignac in April 2006.
Je suis la grande faiblesse, rien que par politesse, de répondre alors encore.